This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you want to talk with Zorba? Call 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with the calls, always some good research to kick around.
Yes, we're going to talk about sleep and how that may be an important factor in obesity in children.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep or the lack of it. And does attitude really overcome cancer? Let's look at the data. Let's look at the facts.
Oh, I remember that in the news that they said. Well, we'll talk about it later.
We will.
We have our medical myth buster. Can the weather really affect your arthritis? Coming up later, what's our recipe?
Sweet and sour apple chops. When you think of pork, you think of something that may be high fat. This is actually a low-fat pork recipe.
Oh, my goodness. The best of all worlds. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help you?
Well, my son has a problem. I have a problem, too. And it's with his laundry. I noticed when he's now 21, but I noticed when he, about puberty, he started leaving, like, marks on the sheet, orange, like body, his whole body. And underwear, T-shirts, the collars of shirts, mainly where, I mean, you know, where he would sweat heavily, but even on, like, when I would change the sheets, there'd be a body print in orange.
In orange?
In orange, yeah. Now, you know, I mean, I change the sheets often, the underwear and everything gets done every day, but he has this, it's an orange stain. Pillowcases, too. I mean, it's like he has an imprint of his body on.
Well, now, does he eat a lot of carrots or drink a lot of orange juice?
No. I mean, I would say in Oconomowoc we have a high iron content in our water, but my husband and I aren't affected this way.
Yeah, I don't think it's due to the iron content in the water, but I've got to ask a question. Now, wait a minute. He's 21.
Yeah.
And you do the laundry?
Well, you know, when he comes home from college, it's like I think he thinks that mom needs a little, you know, mommy.
Uh-huh.
So he goes, here's my laundry, mom.
Uh-huh.
But generally he does it, you know, throughout the year. He just brings it the occasion that he comes home. And, I mean, I thought, well, maybe he would outgrow this.
Zorba's got a great point there. You know, when he's through college, he's going to be back home in that
yeah.
bedroom.
That's right. In that bedroom with mom doing the laundry. Okay. So he doesn't just save up the entire year's laundry and bring it home, so he's wearing all that smelly clothes during the year, but has that. You know, basically what happens is when you go through puberty, you produce sweat through the apocrine glands, which are basically glands that are under your arm. It's the sweat that gives a smell to it and actually produces a stain. You know, you see, typically years ago, before we had antiperspirants, you would have actually pads for men underneath their shirts, because otherwise they would stain them permanently. They would sweat, and basically antiperspirants were developed, which are an aluminum compound, they would tend to sweat less. And basically, your boy, he sweats a lot.
Okay.
And that's basically what it is. There's nothing abnormal about it, nothing bad about it. You don't have to be concerned about it.
But orange?
Yeah.
Well, it discolors it.
And I can't get it out of the clothes.
Yeah, how about using bleach? Well, you can't use bleach unless he wears white. That's
exactly it.
So you have not been able to get it out of the clothes. So you want, well, you know what? I've got lots of expertise. I've got lots of answers to lots of questions. I can look at things and see. But when it comes to laundry, I don't have the final answer. You know, you'll have to call up Dr. Tide if you want to find out what the final answer is.
Now, I do. I mean, he never wears antiperspirant, always deodorant. Now, would that make a difference
There's no doubt about it. Antiperspirant will make a difference if you wear it under the arms because you sweat less. So he uses deodorant. Why doesn't he use antiperspirant?
His mother doesn't buy it, and so I never bought it, so he doesn't buy it. I mean, he really doesn't have a problem odor-wise.
Uh-huh. Now, wait, I want to get this straight. So wait a second. Mom does the laundry, and mom buys the toiletries, and he's 21.
But he buys whatever. I mean, he's like one of those. He's like Pavlov. He knows only what the brand, you know, he buys the soap because that's the kind mom always bought. He buys the, you know.
I got
it. He doesn't buy anything but what he knows. And so I've never used antiperspirant. So that, are you saying that might help?
Well, it'll certainly help with sweating under the arms.
It
whether
won't help
or not
with
it will
sweating
help
everywhere else.
It probably is not going to help with sweating everywhere else.
Okay.
Also, how hot is the room?
As I understand, the dorms, you know, and the apartments are kept pretty darn cool because they don't want to pay the price for heating.
Right. Sometimes it is. It's due to the heat that's there.
Yeah,
too.
And I know at our house, which this happened when he, you know, when he was young. We keep it in the 50s.
In the 50s, so
yeah.
Nice and cool. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
You notice how she was avoiding every time you would say he should do his own laundry. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think that's going to happen either. It's pretty obvious he's not going to do his own laundry at home and that mom is pretty good to this particular son. So, you know, time will tell. Yeah. Eventually he'll be on his own.
800-462-7413. Let's talk about this research you mentioned, Zorba, suggesting that more sleep can cut kids' obesity risk.
Absolutely. Very interesting study that came out of Chicago that looked at third graders. Now, we know that third graders who are overweight tend to be sixth graders who are obese. We know obesity is a big problem in our society. It's a great big problem in children. Children are much bigger today than they were 20 and 30 years ago. There's no doubt about it.
But how did this study link lack of sleep to that obesity?
Well, and it's very interesting. The study shows basically that, I mean, it says that for every hour of sleep that a third grader spends, you reduce the risk that he'll be obese by about 40%. Well, that's a huge number. That's very hard for me to believe, but there were some kids who generally slept, believe it or not, nearly 10 hours, 9 hours, 45 minutes were the least likely to be obese. And the kids who slept basically 7 hours a night were the ones who were most likely to be obese. And one question is, well, maybe they're just around food more and they're going to watch more television, do more, video games, do more games on the TV and so on. But it's also maybe because they produce more of a hormone called ghrelin, which is G-H-R-E-L-I-N, ghrelin, and they may produce less leptin. And these are two internal hormones that are actually, we think, responsible for appetite and appetite control. And when I say we think, the research is not specific basically on how much these hormones do to appetite.
There is a certain logic to this because you could say that kids who don't get enough sleep would be more nervous and more stressed, and maybe nervous and stress leads to eating more food. That would make some sense to me.
And from a sleep point of view, we know that kids need more sleep, and we know that we're in a society where we all get less sleep. But I find this study very interesting because, you know, the average person now gets about 6 to 7 hours of sleep. Maybe it's an adult issue. Maybe if adults went to sleep 8 to 9 hours a night, they would be less obese. Maybe what we're looking at is not the issue of fast food and the availability of food and carbohydrates and high fructose corn syrup. Maybe we should nap.
Yeah.
And if you nap in the middle of the day, maybe you'll weigh less.
Yeah, sleep is really important for kids. I think I remember hearing that sleep problems can impair kids' IQ as much as lead exposure.
Well, we know, for instance, that kids who sleep more tend to do better on tests in school and achievement tests.
Yeah.
So we know that getting your child in bed to have enough sleep is very important, and I would recommend it to everyone.
800-462-7413, toll free. To Peekskill, New York we go. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thank you for taking my call, and I think you have adorable voices.
Oh, aren't you nice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You have an adorable voice, too.
Oh, thank you. That's nice to hear, especially since I just turned 32.
Oh, happy birthday.
Well, I'm not sure about that because I think I have laugh lines.
Oh.
Yeah, and the irony is I'm still treating my face with Retin-A for adolescent onset acne.
Laugh lines meaning what? Just a little bit around the eyes are you talking about?
No, I think they're also called nasolabial lines from the nose down to the somewhere below the lips, but they outline the lips.
Yeah. Well, Zorba will have his answer. Mine is easy. Just be cranky like I am all the time and stop laughing.
Then I might get frown lines.
Yeah, then they'd be frown lines. That's exactly it.
Now,
do you use the Retin-A, which, by the way, is actually a good drug to help with wrinkles and lines? Do you use it around the laugh lines?
Yeah, I use it all over my face. I think it's helped me to keep younger. People mistake me for someone in my 20s.
Uh-huh.
But
okay.
My doctor says that actually it doesn't help that much.
But it does help to some extent. Even though it doesn't help that much, it can make a difference. And that's basically why a number of drugs came out a number of years ago to help with that. What do you do in the sun right now? Do you get a suntan or do you stay out of the sun?
I avoid the sun. Actually, I've been thinking of using microdermabrasion to remove the laugh lines because they're available over-the-counter and they're very inexpensive. I'm concerned because I use the Retin-A, and I'm not sure if microdermabrasion would be ideal for laugh lines, given that there are other alternatives out there which are specifically made for laugh lines, like the injectables.
Somebody tell me what is this what is that?
Microdermabrasion.
Abrasion.
It's like an exfoliant. It removes the top layer of skin so that your younger, healthier skin from underneath the top layer is shown, and you look more youthful. You have a glow, and it might even out the skin tone and remove blotchiness.
Right. And so the idea behind it is to remove that top layer so that the other layer, which is beneath that, may have, as you say, more of a glow. We don't actually have electricity in our skin to give the glow, but it's really reflected light that's off there. It will do no harm at all. It may help your laugh lines. You raise some really important issues. It's cheap and it's inexpensive. The problem with the injectable collagen and the collagen-like substitutes is that, number one, they'll work. There's no doubt about it. They work in the right hands. They're very expensive. I mean, they're not cheap at all. You're talking about $500 to $1,000 for a series of injections, and they have to be repeated.
Every 6 months.
You bet. Every 6 months. Some are lasting longer, but so here it is. Once you start, you're hooked in for every 6 month injections, and then you're hooked into the complications that may occur with the injections. In other words, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, things may be fine, and then all of a sudden you have an injection, and then you get a blotch, you know, a black and blue mark in the skin where you have the injection, and then the embarrassment of that, or the issues involved with it. So whatever you can do superficially is the better way to go with any dermabrasion, anything to sort of exfoliate, as you said, that top surface of the skin.
Okay, and will there be is there any contraindication with Retin-A and microdermabrasion?
Not at all. There's no contraindication. You can use them both, and you have to keep up with it. Now, let me ask you about your mom and your dad. What does your mom's face look like?
Neither of my parents ever had acne.
Uh-huh. Okay. What about laugh lines? What about, did they have premature aging of their skin?
No, actually, my mom is in her 50s, and she has virtually no wrinkles, but she does have the laugh lines, which make her look permanently sad.
Is your mom a sad person?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe that's why she looks sad. Maybe she is sad. Maybe it's not just the lines. Maybe your mom is sad because she's sad. Is she getting therapy or on antidepressants? Has she looked at her diet? Or?
No, she's very old-fashioned and stubborn, so she refuses. She thinks she can do everything on her own.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, good luck.
Thank you, Zorba.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's take a question now from Adam in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Adam is a classical guitar performer who battled a bout of stage fright. During his research on how to curb this, Adam found out that Valium used to be prescribed. Well, he didn't think he'd perform too well with that. So much like you, Zorba, his doctor recommended the beta blocker Enderol. Adam has taken it 3 times now and thinks it works like magic, but he's curious to know if there are any long-term effects of using it for each performance.
There are no long-term effects at all. It's a safe drug to use. It's been used. It's been on the market for 20, 25 years. Very safe. What it does is you're going out on stage. You get anxious. You shoot adrenaline into your bloodstream. And what, among other things, it elevates your blood pressure, suddenly elevates your pulse suddenly. Mm-hmm. When that occurs, you then become anxious. In other words, you have the feeling of a fast pulse. It makes you anxious. And then you develop that whole, if you will, cycle of anxiety. It feeds the pulse and you develop stage fright. So what this does is it blocks that cycle. It blocks the fast pulse. And as a result, you have more control and you have less tremor. So your voice is less tremulous, you know, that kind of tremulousness you get when you're anxious. And it's very good for anyone, especially violin players, because that little tremor can make a huge difference when you're playing the violin. And about half the violin players in the country in symphony orchestras who do not have stage fright take beta blockers because they develop anxiety when they're trying to hit certain notes.
Yeah. Adam plays guitar, but it'd be the same principle, obviously.
Absolutely.
You used
it's
to,
not addictive. It's not habit-forming. It really
You
works.
Give a lot of speeches. Didn't you used to take take stuff like this?
I've tried beta blockers, and what I've done is I've taken beta blockers because I've had a fast pulse. I don't actually have stage fright, and when I've taken them, I've discovered that the bad pulse, the fast pulse, doesn't go away. I call it a bad pulse, and it's very interesting. But some people have control. Other people do not. And the fact is, if it breaks it and it's easy and it's not addictive and it's work, and it works rather, I think it's useful.
Ever tried Valium?
I don't think I'd make it to the speech, Tom.
Well, don't you have anxiety about sending us your thoughts? Just email your comments, questions, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener now, Zorba, in Enterprise, Alabama. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. How are you guys doing today?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I've been trying to lose a little weight, so I changed the way I eat, and I've lost about 30 pounds, but I wanted to add fresh fruits and vegetables. But I find that when I eat fresh apples particularly or carrots, that my mouth gets really itchy in the roof of the mouth, and it's discomforting, and I sort of avoided the fresh fruit and vegetable thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the carrot, when you take the carrots, these are bad carrots, or are they carrots that you actually take and you scrape off the surface? You know,
these are carrots that I've scraped off the skinned or peeled.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And cut up and chopped up. And in fact, with the carrots, if I've done that and I touch my eyes, I'll even get a little swelling and an allergic reaction around my eyes if I do that.
Oh, that's very interesting. How about the apples? Now, the apples, when you do it with apples, do you wash the apple beforehand? Do you peel the apple at all or not?
I wash the apple. It doesn't matter whether I peel it or not, but I usually slice it and cut it up.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same thing with peaches. And if I eat a peach or an apple, the roof of my mouth, I just have this discomforting itching in the roof of my mouth for a good 20 or 30 minutes afterwards.
Okay, now is this related to the amount of fruit that you're eating? Like, does one apple do it, or is it two or three apples?
That's one apple, one carrot, it'll do it.
Okay. Well, first of all,
and if they're cooked, I know you guys are coming up with a recipe here. If you cook those apples or put them in an apple pie, it's no big deal at all.
Uh-huh. Oh. Well, this is clearly a food intolerance to something. Obviously, there are vitamins, for instance. There are vitamins, there are phytoestrogens and other minerals that are present in apples, which when you cook them, apples or carrots or any fruit or vegetable, when you cook them, they tend to decrease. And they basically are often destroyed by eating. I'm not sure if that is what is producing this hypersensitivity or if it's some of the pesticides that are actually used for them. And so one of my recommendations always when people have fresh fruits, fresh veggies, they're bothered by them, is to wash them thoroughly with just water, no soap at all. Plain water will often reduce with a vegetable brush or a fruit brush, will reduce the residue that's on the surface. That's the first thing to do. Second thing to do is see if it's very specific for the product. So you may discover, for instance, one carrot product, literally in a bag, works, and the other one does not work, because usually they put sulfites on carrots that are in the bags, and some may have more sulfites than others, and these are to preserve freshness and to preserve the color, and that may be indeed what is doing it. Do you have any trouble with wine, red wine in specific?
No, I generally don't drink any red wine.
Because the reason is red wine often has more sulfites, and this may also be the issue. What about when you go to salad bars? Problem with salad bars?
No, typically no problem with salad bars, but again, I just find that if I avoid cut up apples in my salad, I'm better off than if I don't.
Well, you may want to simply avoid that because of essentially the chemical that may be on the surface or because of the mineral that's there. So I would recommend just avoid it. Look, though, to see if it's specific for one apple versus another, one carrot bag versus another carrot bag, because it may be more specific than you think.
Sure. Sure. Okay.
I'm glad you can eat the cooked apples, because you'll want to stick around for the recipe.
It's a great one.
Most of the problem with these cooked apples, though, is they come with great sugary sauce.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
Well, congrats, too, on losing that 30 pounds.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And thanks for calling.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye-bye. We have our recipe coming up, of course, for sweet and sour apple chops. We have lots more of your calls coming up, some interesting research, and our medical myth buster. Does the weather really affect your arthritis? Zorba will talk about that later. Here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health, from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. But right now, Zorba, recipe time. This looks so good and it smells so good. Let's get through the ingredients so I can actually taste.
Sweet and sour apple chops. So let's talk about pork. First of all,
can't we just rush through this?
No, not in the least, Tom.
Okay, all right. I'll have patience. All right, let's talk about pork.
Pork is not the other white meat.
Right.
It's not the same as poultry. It's red meat, no matter which way you cut it. It has all the risks of red meat. So once again, just like beef and lamb and pork and any game meat such as venison, we have to limit the amount that we have because we know it is associated with a higher risk of heart disease and stroke. We know that. Mm-hmm. But pork has always had a bad rap in many ways because of trichinosis, which is not in our food supply at all anymore.
Right.
And that's why pork had to be cooked until it was absolutely, totally, thoroughly cooked. I can just tell it's so hard for you to hold your mouth closed. You're just obviously going to have a piece of this. But the issue is that when you deal with pork, if you have a low-fat pork recipe like pork tenderloin or boneless pork chops that are low-fat pork chops, they can be part of a healthful diet. And I think it's important to look at that because this particular recipe, when we look at it, only has 7 grams of fat, 11% of your minimum daily requirement, and 285 calories from a typical boneless pork chop. It's a great recipe, and it uses apples. So you've taken a recipe and made it into something that is delicious and good. How does it taste?
It's delicious and good.
It's delicious and good. All right, I think now that Tom is eating this, we should actually go through the recipe.
Good.
Sweet and sour apple chops.
Mm-hmm.
Start out with non-stick cooking spray.
Non-stick cooking spray.
So why do we use that, Tom?
Why do
we use it?
So it doesn't stick.
Doesn't stick. That's exactly right. And it doesn't add calories. And it doesn't have much fat.
Gotcha.
It has 0 calories. It actually probably has 1 or 2 calories. It's as close to 0 as you can do. And that's exactly what we want. A low-fat recipe, we've got to end up sort of loosening it so basically it won't get stuck. 4 5-ounce boneless pork chops, 3/4 inch thick.
4 5-ounce boneless pork chops, 3/4 inch thick.
That's right. So it's a pork chop that is reasonably thick. Salt and pepper to taste. You're going to use, of course.
Salt and pepper to taste.
1 teaspoon of dried oregano.
A little tea, dried oregano.
Right. I often use an Italian spice, and I go to a great Italian spice. We have a local purveyor in our area. But go to a good spice purveyor, and if you use Italian spice, it has a mixture of oregano and other spices, usually really brightens up the recipe quite a bit. 1 tablespoonful of olive oil.
A big tea olive oil.
Okay. 2 large apples, unpeeled, cored, and sliced into 1 1/2-inch wedges.
2 big apples, unpeeled, cored, and cut into 1/2-inch wedges.
That's right. And I use Granny Smith for the most part.
Okay.
Why? They're tangy. Mm-hmm. I like the taste of them. I almost never use Red Delicious. I don't like Red Delicious. They tend to be a pretty red apple with not much of a taste. Roma is also a good apple. A palm apple is often good. I'll tell you, if you look at apples and you try different apples, you will find one you like. And instead of doing it by hand, I have one of those little not peeler, but they're cores. They kind of look like they're a circle. I don't know what you call them, but you kind of push it into the apple. You know what I'm talking about?
A corer.
Yeah, I think it's called a corer.
I think that's
you know, it's hard. You know, the grammar police will probably correct me. Okay, large onion cut into 1 1/2-inch wedges.
Large onion cut into 1/2-inch wedges.
1/3 cup of unsweetened apple juice.
1/3 cup of unsweetened apple juice.
1/4 cup of apple cider vinegar.
1/4 cup of apple cider vinegar.
So
this is so delicious.
You love it. You love the taste of it. So spray a large nonstick skillet with cooking spray. Heat over medium heat. Season the pork chops with salt and pepper, and then saute for about 5 minutes. Then sprinkle the chops with a 1/2 teaspoon of oregano. Flip the chops, season again if desired. My recommendation is do it. And when you're using salt, use kosher salt or sea salt. And then saute for an additional 3 minutes. Then transfer the chops to a plate and cover it tightly with foil. Now, in the same skillet, heat up the olive oil, add the apple and the onion wedges, season with the remaining oregano, and sauté for about 8 to 10 minutes until the onions are tender. And very importantly, it's important to scrape the bottom of the pan as you're doing that, because that's really where all the delicious juice comes in. Then return the pork and the juices back to the skillet. Add the apple juice and the vinegar. Cook until the liquid reduces a bit, until the pork is heated through just a few minutes. And if you need to, on the table, season with a little bit of salt and pepper. And bon appetit, and you can serve it. And I am going to have...
No, no, that's mine.
Oh, that's yours.
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I can't have yours. I just have to have it. I have to have a little bit
of
here.
I'm trying to figure out what it is about. Yeah. I've never had a pork chop that was this tasty and spicy. It's the combination, I guess, of the oregano and the olive oil and the onion. It's really delicious.
This is delicious. This is delicious. As I said, 285 calories for each chop, 11% of the fat that you need. Yes, there's some saturated fat, but it's only 2 grams out of 7 grams. It's still a heart-healthy recipe.
This is, as I say, very delicious. You're going to want this recipe. Let us send it to you. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. Our zip code is 53706. Be sure to enclose that business-sized self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send the recipe along to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can get this recipe, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast.
The number to call if you have a question for Zorba is 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener is with us now in DeBary, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
How can we help you?
Well, about a year ago, I had my thyroid removed.
So you had hyperthyroidism. You had an overactive thyroid.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I'm 56, and I am trying to lose weight, and I just can't. Mm-hmm. I've maintained, although I go up 3 pounds and down 3 pounds, and up 3 pounds and down 3 pounds. I've tried a really good diet. Mm-hmm. I exercise 5 days a week, and I think if I didn't watch what I eat and if I didn't exercise, I'd probably weigh 200 pounds.
You know, one of the issues with diet that's very difficult is the yo-yo diet, where people go up and down and back and forth, where they gain and they lose 3 pounds one way and 3 pounds another way. I think one of the best movies I saw on dieting is Super Size Me. It's a great movie because it's a funny movie about a guy who eats nothing but McDonald's, and after 1 month, he gained 22 pounds, and you get to see it. It's a very funny movie. But watch the movie until it's the end. At the end of the credits. It took him 1 month to put it on and 1 month to put it on, and it took him 9 months to take it off. In other words, what you have to do is you have to look from a point of view of what you're eating, limit your calories, and you have to stick with it. And what happens is they tend to creep up. And 100 or 150 calories can be the difference of 10 pounds at the end of a year, and it's very, very easy to get 100 more calories. So I would say stick to it. Look at that diet. As you said, you were in a good diet, but the fact is you're getting the calories from somewhere. They're not just coming from the air. The other problem is, as we begin to limit ourselves, our body becomes more efficient. And so we have to continue to limit ourselves and do that exercise, because the body, frankly, is much more efficient when we start to limit our calories. So
try to do that intuitive stuff, or more mind control.
Yeah, more mind control. And, you know, these are difficult problems. I mean, if I had an absolute answer on diet, I'd have a best-selling book,
of course.
I'd be on Oprah Winfrey like every other diet maven. And the problem is, as you know, the proliferation of diet books is directly responsible for the increase in obesity in our society. I mean, the reality is half of all the self-help books on the market sold today are diet books, and there's no diet book that hits there. It's just the fad du jour. It's a big problem. But I think there are individual things that you can do as an individual person, and one thing you can do is look and see where your calories are coming from. We try to remove them and limit them, and then continue with it.
Oprah Winfrey is a step down from public,
right? Oh, yes, right, yes. 800. She's good. Oprah's good.
1-800 1-800-462-7413. Give us a call. A listener joins us now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a question about cooking, using aluminum foil with anything. I went on a cooking retreat, and the teacher said that, and I forgot what she said, you're either supposed to keep the shiny side away from the food or the dull side away from the food. And I don't know which it is. I think the dull side of the foil should be kept away from the food.
Yeah. If you're taking it out of the oven, you're talking about now, right?
I'm talking about putting it into the oven and cooking it for however long.
Oh, okay.
Or wrapping food up in foil.
I always assuming that the shiny side would keep the heat in better, would put the shiny side against the food and the dull side out. Zorba, okay. was I wrong about that?
Well, because I like the way the pot looks, would always put the dull side next to the food and put the shiny side out, because that's what my mother taught me. And years ago, when I was a little kid, my mother only bought Kaiser aluminum foil because it was quilted. You remember that? It was quilted?
Yeah.
No. It was quilted foil.
But wouldn't the shiny side do a better job of reflecting the heat?
I don't think it does anything at all.
You don't think it makes a darn bit of difference?
In the least, it's because what you're actually doing is putting a top on top of the food so that the moisture doesn't escape.
Yeah.
And you can't do it necessarily with plastic, but that's all you're doing when you're actually putting aluminum foil on it. And it doesn't make a difference. The aluminum really doesn't come off of the foil at all, and that's why it's hard to remember.
I think that was the issue.
The issue was whether or not you get little particles or molecules of aluminum in the food.
Whether there's a safety issue.
Oh, you bet.
Well, I never thought there was a safety issue.
Whether or not there's a connection to Alzheimer's disease, because we know that there are aluminum in the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease. We know now that there is no safety issue with actually cooking in aluminum with Alzheimer's disease, but that's what the issue was about. And the reason why you can't remember whether it's dull side in or dull side out is it doesn't matter.
I thought the reason I couldn't remember is because I've got Alzheimer's disease. Putting the foil on the wrong way.
So tell me, caller, how do you put aluminum on your food when you put it into the oven?
Well, up until a few years ago, I didn't really think about it. I had the shiny side out because, like you say, it's just prettier that way.
That's right. That's right.
But then I did some research through a particular cookbook, and they said put the shiny side facing the food with the dull side up.
Uh-huh. And in reality, it makes
which
no difference.
Which is the right way.
Which is not the right way. That's the way your mother did it. The right way is the way my mother did it.
No, I don't think there was aluminum foil or not.
That's right. Pre-aluminum foil. You're not that old, Tom. You're not that old.
So it doesn't make any difference.
Not at all.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And here's a bonus recipe, speaking of foil, Zorba, from Michael in Sandpoint, Idaho. He calls it, are you ready for this, Zorba?
Okay, I'm ready.
Dishwasher salmon. This is really neat. Michael writes, this is a very simple way to cook salmon that we've been using in my family for years. To some, it sounds crazy, but it is really just a creative way to poach a fish. Start out with a nice fillet of wild salmon, season it, and then double or triple wrap in heavy-duty foil. I've cut corners with this part, and trust me, your dishwasher will be very fishy for quite a while. Then, simply run it through one dishwashing cycle. No soap required. I prefer rare to raw fish, but if you don't, you can run it through another cycle or stick it in the oven and quickly broil it or bake it to your liking. But remember, fish keeps cooking even after you take it out of the heat. Get creative. I hope you enjoy it.
Dishwasher salmon. I love it. I love it. It's something we absolutely should actually follow up. I should make a recipe of dishwasher salmon. This reminds me of cooking a roast in your car on the top of the engine. Do you remember that?
Sure.
I bought a book about that years ago, How to Cook While You're Driving Dishwasher Salmon.
Well, there's a certain practical thing to that, because when you could be in your car and not be near a stove. But
absolutely.
Why would you put it in the dishwasher?
You know, everyone wants to do something creative in life, and clearly his family was the dishwasher cookers.
Well,
they
now,
need a cookbook.
Here's a question.
Cooking in your dishwasher.
Here's a question you may not be able to answer, Zorba, but someone out there will. I wonder what the energy consumption difference is between running the dishwasher through a whole cycle and using your stove to cook a salmon.
You mean so it may not be green?
I'm thinking that might very well
be. That may not be the case.
Somebody will let us know.
Absolutely, I'm sure.
Yeah. If you have a tip you'd like to share with our listeners, let us hear it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have more calls coming up, some really interesting research, and our medical myth buster. And this is, you're going to want to hear about this. Can weather really affect your arthritis? You may believe one way or another. Zorba will clarify that for you later on. Here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health, from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that number, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, some research on attitude and cancer. And maybe we're wrong when we say if you have a really, really good attitude, you're more likely to beat cancer.
Well, looking at this particular study, that's exactly what you would say. And we have to look at the study, analyze it, what we know. But first, let's look back to past history. Mm-hmm. Let's look at 30 years ago. 30 years ago, if you had cancer, the C word, you didn't say it, you didn't talk to other people, you didn't have a support system, they would say, oh, she's sick or he's sick. And basically, there was no support system at all. And the early data that really dealt with support systems for cancer showed the difference, because usual care at that time was don't talk about it, don't mention it, and don't discuss it at all.
But you say the support system made a difference. That seems to go against this.
Well, that's what, because 30 years ago, usual care was no support system, don't talk about it at all, leave your friends out of the loop and your family.
Okay.
Now, we switch over to today, and we find that support is the norm, is the common thing. And the issue is, what does it do? So we're now, you know, 30 years ago, we compared it to the usual care, which was no support. Mm-hmm. Now we're comparing it to the usual care, which is clearly a supportive environment
and
that's around it.
What does this say?
They didn't find any difference. In other words, they looked at 1,000 people with head and neck cancer. This is one of several studies looking at a positive mental attitude, variety of psychological ways of evaluating whether people who are more positive. They looked at relaxation, meditation, prayer to see whether or not there was any difference in the prolongation of life for this particular type of cancer, head and neck cancer, and they found no. There was no difference in attitude in terms of how attitude affected longevity. In other words, good attitude, bad attitude, it appeared that you lived about just as long.
Yeah, but of course that study doesn't speak to the time that the cancer patient is still alive and
absolutely.
What the quality of life is during that period.
Quality of life is a very important issue. In other words, we know that support groups, that prayer, that meditation, and psychotherapy for some people are very, very important with quality of life. But the other side of this is what some people call the tyranny of, hey, if you died early, that's because you didn't have the right attitude and you gave up. Blame the patient. So the other side of this is, wait a minute, we're blaming people who don't have the right attitude and saying that's why their cancer is progressing. And I think the study shows no, their cancer is progressing regardless of what their attitude is. We know a good attitude helps quality, but from a quantity point of view, that's a tyranny there.
I'm going to make some enemies on the part of the listeners here with this, but I get a little bit put off by some of the obits that talk about a valiant fight against cancer. when I think of myself as possibly getting this terrible disease and dying from, I don't know if I want to do a valiant fight. I think I want to have as good a time as I possibly can. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think when you look at something like that, and I know what you're talking about when you're looking at the obituaries, it's a function of the family, the relatives, and what they actually want to show. And a valiant fight against cancer, to me, is a positive statement that somebody made. But for you, it may not be, and that's why they're individual things.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you today?
Oh, fantastic. You are just so positive. I love listening to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
You don't love listening to me, the negative guy?
Well, you know, I think you're wonderful, too. I don't know if Zorba could do it without him.
There we go.
How can Zorba help you?
Well, Zorba, I have a question, and I don't know how you think of this, whether it's the body's own methodology or whether, you know, it's God put it there on purpose, but I have a question about laser hair removal. And I'm wondering, you know, I can understand if it's on a man's back and it's unwanted, but in places where it may be put for purposes of protecting the body or, you know, things like that, like underarms, bikini area, those kinds of things, are there any risks in getting permanent laser hair removal?
Not at all. It's a cosmetic, you know, cosmetic procedure, whether it's done by electrolysis or another, you know, any other particular way of removing it. There is no problem at all in removal of hair, no problem at all in terms of complications that occur. Like any other surgical procedure, of course, you can have infections, you can have scarring and so on. But from a point of view of health, no. Unless you're a diabetic who's not in control, I think it's just fine.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's just fine. You know, it's very interesting because, you know, there are people who are comfortable with doing, you know, with having it removed, and other people say, well, why do you do it? That's me. I shouldn't remove it like that.
Yeah.
I think these are very individual questions, just like other cosmetic questions. It's an individual choice.
Doesn't it hurt?
Oh, yes. And there's different theories on lidocaine. Apparently, if you put too much on, you could get a reaction and die. So a lot of these treatments, you go in without any kind of numbing on the outside, and you just sort of grin and bear it and jump off the table every now and then.
Well, you don't actually, with lidocaine, you won't actually die from the lidocaine that's topically used. That's definitely an old wives' tale. There is no doubt about that. And that's because lidocaine, injectable, is something that we used to use all the time for cardiac rhythm problems with your heart that we don't use anymore at all.
Yeah.
But the fact is, no, you're not going to die suddenly from having no lidocaine.
Now, can I ask, is this something that you are doing already and want to just get Zorba's opinion, or is it something you're contemplating and Zorba will make the final call as to whether you do it or not?
No, it's something I began and I've done about 5 sessions, but I was just curious, you know, watching it disappear, thinking, you know, am I ever going to want this back?
It does not cause any problems. You can have as many procedures as you want to. How many you going to have in total? Do you know?
I really don't know. I'm going to keep going until it's gone. But I'm wondering, is there a certain percentage of lidocaine you can buy over the counter if the clinic doesn't provide it to cut down on the pain?
Well, the lidocaine may or may not cut down on the pain. Topical lidocaine, for the most part, doesn't do it unless you actually inject it beneath the skin. But you can just go. You can use on the skin. You can go and use a preparation that contains Americaine. That's what it says. It says Americaine. And you can use that, and it's for hemorrhoids. And basically, it is a topical type anesthetic, easy, cheap. You can use that, and that's what I would try. If not, you may actually have to call your doctor and get one of the prescription strength lidocaine to try that on the surface.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you. And
good luck.
And just remember, pain is good for the soul.
Okay.
It's
well,
good
thank
for
you there.
The soul. Where did that come from?
I just made it up. Thanks a lot for the call.
Well, very nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Nice talking with you, too. So long. 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's take a moment for our medical myth buster now. Our myth today deals with arthritis. You've heard from time to time about people predicting a storm or bad weather because their tricked knees are acting up. But can weather really affect your arthritis?
Well, from a scientific point of view, from a point of view of where we're actually looking at people and whether or not on bad days where the weather is overcast and the barometric pressure is up, their pain gets worse.
Yeah.
And on good days when it's sunny and the barometric pressure isn't up, and you measure it every day, you don't think back to that day,
right.
There appears to be absolutely no scientific basis for the idea that bad weather will do it. But what do you think?
Well, I just heard the science. What I think is there are a whole lot of listeners who are going to be saying, you are absolutely wrong about this because my arthritis can predict the weather.
And, you know, it's very interesting because I've heard that. I have patients who come in. They tell me all the time they know when the barometric pressure is up because their arthritis predicts the weather, and they know what the weather is. And we know that the weather outside affects our brain. It affects our mood. It affects our ability to get above the pain and discomfort from arthritis. So from that point of view, it makes sense. But according to this, the science is not behind it.
Well, prove it. What is the science you're talking about?
Well, the particular science looked at this particular area, looked at 18 people, followed them for 15
minutes. How many people?
18.
18 people. Oh, well.
18
case
people.
Closed.
18 people.
Massive study.
18 people. Well, here's another study. 75 people. Okay, 75 people with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
Looking at local weather conditions, you know, and they didn't find any difference. So, all right. Okay. All right, you've converted me. Yes, thanks. The myth is true. The weather does affect arthritis. I'm a believer, I believe.
Well, if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust or not to bust or to leave hanging, just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And, Zorba, our next caller is with us from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, my question is, next month I'm getting married, and we would like to trying to have kids immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And my fiancé had heard that you shouldn't have a flu shot or any vaccinations while you're pregnant. And so the question is, if we're trying immediately to start to have kids, should we wait a little bit to have the kids, or should she try to get a flu shot immediately so there's some space in between that time, or does it matter?
Well, the difference when we look at vaccination, the issue is what vaccinations do you get while you're actually pregnant? Because some vaccines have a live virus and some vaccines do not. The flu vaccine is an inactivated virus. There's nothing live in it at all. And basically, if you're not pregnant now, there is no issue in getting the flu vaccine. Getting the influenza vaccine is just fine. And I recommend it to anyone who wants it or anyone who falls into a high-risk group, senior citizens, somebody with a chronic medical problem such as diabetes, hypertension, and so on. So those people should definitely get a vaccine, and she can have a flu shot. It's the other immunizations, some of which are contraindicated when you're actually pregnant. But she's not pregnant now, so now indeed is a good time. Tell me, how old is your fiancé?
He's 30.
Okay, she's 30. Now, has she ever had, she probably had the measles, mumps, the MMR, and German measles vaccine in the past. Most people would have had that twice, so she would not have to be immunized for that. Is she looking at other immunizations?
I'm not sure. She's foreign, so, I mean, there may be some immunizations that we get in the United States that, you know, she hasn't gotten yet.
Right. And you know something? That you bring up a really good point. So what you'd like to do is, you know, you want to get her hooked up with a doctor, check to see what immunization she has before she gets pregnant. She certainly can get a flu shot, although generally, you know, 30-year-olds who are healthy, we don't necessarily recommend a flu shot unless people want to have it. And that's kind of the way to look at it. While you're pregnant, though, each immunization, you've got to look up, see if it's safe to have during the pregnancy, and then make a decision. So while you're actually pregnant, it really becomes a different
decision.
Well,
this is a good thing. I mean, this is you put it on the list. When you're planning the wedding,
right.
You do the guest list, you do the cake, you do the band, you do the flu shot. you want to get it all planned out.
But it is true. You know, as you said, you're thinking about getting pregnant right away. It is true. You actually do want to get it planned out. So where are you guys going to go on your honeymoon?
We're not sure yet. It may be in a small area in Oregon. We may try the Caribbean. Who knows? Okay. we're kind of putting off the honeymoon a little
you
bit.
Got, you got a big wedding plan?
We do have a big wedding plan, yes.
Where'd you meet?
We met in Ecuador.
Oh.
I've been to Ecuador. Beautiful country. Just wonderful, friendly people.
Zorba's been everywhere.
Yeah.
It's the truth. Well, have a great marriage and have a great wedding beforehand and get the flu shots first off.
All right.
Bye-bye. Take care. Good luck, and good luck on the marriage.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Quickly, before we go, Zorba, our listeners would like to know if a correction or maybe a clarification is needed. Now, on a recent show, we were chatting about cold decongestants for toddlers. You remember that?
Absolutely, Tom.
You suggested home remedies may be the better route to go. One tip you mentioned for a sore throat was honey and water. Now, many of our listeners sent notes to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox wondering if honey was safe to give to a toddler because it's not pasteurized.
Well, you can get pasteurized honey. First of all, there are rules for toddlers. You're right. Below the age of 6 months, honey is not recommended. That's absolutely the case below the age of 6 months. So she does bring up a good point. But you can buy pasteurized honey. That's the only time that I recommend that people actually take and give to children. For adults, I think it's a different issue. And basically, you can take honey and you can boil it yourself. I mean, you can put the jar in the water, boil it in the water, and keep it boiled for about 30 to 45 minutes. But under the age of 6 months, and if you have honey questions, you can go to cdc.gov, G-O-V, and we'll have a connection to the honey questions on our website.
Well, just so I'm clear, is pasteurized honey okay for under 6 months?
No, under 6 months, there's a recommendation to not to use honey. That is still
Why?
The recommendation. Well, it has to do with, you know, first of all, it has to do with whether or not pasteurization really kills all of the toxins that can be present. And if I remember correctly, and I don't remember exactly, this may have to do with botulism toxin and children. But the last recommendation that I read from the CDC said under 6 months, honey was not recommended. Now, do people really give honey to children under 6 months? Absolutely. But the recommendations that I last read said no.
Okay. Well, we want to hear from you, of course. Just send us your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, thank you very much.
A pleasure, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Call day or night with your question for Zorba at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.